Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Now You Know, talk radio where you get to ask the questions. Call us now at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. And now, here are your hosts, Ann Mitchell and Brian McCullough.
Hey, good evening, Brian. How are you tonight?
Ann, I'm fantastic. How are you?
I am doing really well as well. But, you know, I have to tell you that I have something that really is kind of flummoxing me, and it's something that I think you and I have talked about a bit. But you know, for our listeners out there, if anyone has any great advice for me or anything, you know, I often say, you know, my son is 12. And I often say that my greatest parenting challenge is that I don't remember what it's like to be a 12-year-old boy.
That's right, because I don't think you ever were one, right?
I never was a 12-year-old boy. And I have to tell you, though, that I have found this book that I'm reading, and it has me so excited, and it's like someone took a flashlight and shone it in this dark corner where I could never really see what was there and has illuminated it for me. It's that great a book about raising boys. And so I'm really excited about it, and it's already really made a difference in how I'm viewing things and how I'm relating to my son. So it's really excited. The name of the book, because I know you're going to ask me. What?
No, I just want to say, before you go too far and embarrass yourself, Harry Potter is not real. So
you're
not
kidding. Don't tell me that.
Okay.
No, it's a real book. It's a real nonfiction book written by two guys whose therapy practices, counseling practices, are entirely adolescent and teenage boys. That's what they specialize in. Independently in two different states, but they collaborate on this book. It's called Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys. And I so highly recommend it. I cannot highly enough recommend it. It's just really, really awesome. So, because, you know, I don't understand boys. You were one once, right?
I was one several times, yes.
You were a boy several times, like in previous lives?
Well, no, I you know, it's interesting because I have one boy and I have two girls, and I don't know, maybe this is the way it is for each gender, but I don't stress about raising my son the way I stress about raising my daughters. And since you've got one of each, maybe you can, did you have the same kind of anxiety with your daughter that you do with your son, or do you just kind of feel natural when it's the same sex?
It is different, but you feel equally nervous and concerned and anxious about both, but in different ways. With my daughter, I actually always knew, and my daughter has been a guest on the show, so you know she's an extremely competent woman, and she really knows her own mind. So I was never worried, as some parents do about daughters, that someone might take advantage of her unless she wanted them to. But with my son, I'm, you know, and from the show last week, I think you've seen or heard that men, boys, really are very discriminated against in our culture. And they grow up to be men and fathers who are also discriminated against. So on top of all the other things you worry about, and Lord knows, as a father's rights lawyer, I worry that, you know, my son's going to get to be a teenager and some young lady wanting to get out of her own bad situation is going to basically coerce him into becoming a teenage father. You know, on top of all that, you worry about everything that we've dealt with in our show last week. So it's just a different set of anxieties. But let's face it, the moment you become a parent, you wear your heart on your sleeve and in your mouth.
And you also wear your wallet in your hand, right?
So. And it's empty. That's right. Anyways, we have got an absolutely wonderful, wonderful guest tonight. I am so very excited about this guest. He is.
Speaking of wearing your wallet and raising kids, right?
Hey, don't you be, that's not always the case. But before we introduce our guest and bring him on, Brian, would you do the honors of telling everyone all the different ways that they can call in?
Absolutely. Now, we'd love for you guys to call in and talk to the amazing surprise guest that we have. Call us at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. That's Now You Know Radio. You can visit us online at nowyouknowradio.com. Send us a tweet at Now You Know Radio. And you can also join our chat room. Go to blogtalkradio.com/nowyouknowradio and join our chat room and pose a question there. Any of those options will get you in touch with Ann and?
Ann and Brian? No.
I was leading you in. I was giving you the door.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm so used to people giving me the door, showing me the door, that, you know, I'm sorry. It kind of just goes right over my head. Anyway, so, yes, our guest tonight is the ever fabulous, extremely competent, and really quite pleasant, Robert Rudman. He is an orthodontist who practices both in Denver and Longmont, Colorado. And he has won awards for his work, and very much understandably. He's very, as I said, he's very competent. He's actually my orthodontist, and so I speak from experience as one of his patients. He's also very personable. He's well-published, and I don't think, you know, I could say any more without risking inflating his head, because all I have to say about him are really good things. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to our listeners Dr. Robert Rudman.
Hi, Anna Brian. How are you?
Hi there. How are you?
Thank
you so much for joining us on the show. I really, really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
So for our listeners out there who have not yet had the pleasure, or perhaps have had the pleasure of not yet, of encountering, having to interact with an orthodontist, could you explain just a little bit about how orthodontics is distinguished from other branches of dentistry, and also what is it about the training? Like, do you go to dental school and then additionally to orthodontic school, or how does the training differ?
Sure. Probably the best route to do this is kind of take you through my journey, which is what most orthodontists do. You basically go to 4 years of college, then go to 4 years of dental school. Generally, orthodontists tend to be in the top 2 or 3% of your class because it's a very competitive field to get into. And then after dental school, you apply to an orthodontic residency, and that's 2 to 3 years depending upon the program you go to. And basically what we focus on is 2 to 3 years of clinical training, and also, depending upon the program, a master's program, where you go through the science of, you know, basically moving people's teeth around, how their profiles change, and basically how to get someone looking great from an orthodontic perspective and smile perspective, and also give them a healthy bite at the same time.
Okay, so how long is dental school?
Dental school is 4 years, and then ortho is 2 to 3.
And then is there also, like with medical school, is there kind of a residency or an internship, or do you just sort of go right out and hang out a shingle?
Well, basically the orthodontic specialty is after you've done the 4 years of dental school, the 3 years of ortho training after that is basically your residency.
Okay, so that sounds to me like you're basically learning and practicing on your patients, but I'm sure that's not really exactly right, is it?
It's pretty close. Basically, you have a didactic and a clinical aspect to the training, so you're in a lot of lectures as well as basically learning under other orthodontists. So the program I went to, we had about 16 orthodontists that we basically, the patients were being treated under their care, but we provided the treatment for them. So we're learning under the auspices of a trained specialist to learn how to do it. And basically the only way you really learn, that's why they call it practice, is by practicing, and we get to do it under the guidance of some really great specialists.
Right. And I didn't mean to set you up there. It's just that I know I often get that question myself, being also a professional as a lawyer and all the jokes about practicing. But really, you know, how do you learn? So I get that, but I did want to, you know, let you flesh that out for the listeners as well.
Sure.
Now, I'm very curious about something. You are known for the non-extraction approach to orthodontic treatment. What does that mean?
Well, orthodontics has gone through an interesting history. Basically, there was two arguments back in the 30s where people thought you'd have more stability if you extracted teeth, and there was the argument that you shouldn't extract teeth. And basically, where things come down is if you look at someone's face, basically half their face comprises their upper and lower jaw. So you can extract teeth and close spaces and basically push people's upper teeth too far back, which kind of prematurely ages them by giving them thinner lips. So what we try to do, and I think most modern orthodontists are going to look at things, and we're not only going to look at, okay, how much room do you have for teeth, but how do your teeth look in your face? And if we mm-hmm. move your teeth forward, does that give you better soft tissue support, nicer lips, so on and so forth? Or if someone's too full and they can't get their lips around their teeth, then that would be an indication to extract teeth. So I would say about 95% of my patients don't get teeth out. But there are cases where you do need to take teeth out. And it's more of how do your teeth look in your face. You can always make room for the teeth. Sometimes that's not a great thing for your face.
Well, see, and now when I had braces the first time back when I was a teenager about 100 years ago, that is exactly what. They pulled all four of my wisdom teeth first, and then they pulled all four of my bicuspids in order for
right.
me to have orthodontia. And
right.
So that sounds quite different from what I went through, although maybe I still would have had to go through that, and I would have been in that 5%. And, of course, now I am under orthodontic treatment, or do you say in orthodontic treatment, with you, which goes to show that for one reason or another, that orthodontic treatment back 100 years ago didn't actually work.
Well, I would say there's two possible components to that, and I'm not trying to second guess your orthodontist, but back in the day when they used to use bands around every tooth, the bands that would fit around every single tooth took up a little bit of room, and in order to get all the bands on people's teeth, you had to take teeth out to make room. Nowadays, most modern orthodontists are going to use little stick-on braces, so there's no separating of teeth. There's no room that has to be taken to get the appliances on. Secondarily, as far as stability goes, I tend to be Mr. Analogy, as you know. I always tell people that your orthodontist is like your personal trainer. You're going to work out. You're going to look awesome, but you have to do something to maintain that. And
mm-hmm.
just like on a diet, you have to maintain a good diet the rest of your life. So retainers are kind of a lifetime thing. Back in the day, they would tell you wear your retainer for a year and you'll be fine, but that's like your personal trainer saying, hey, you went on a diet, so stay that same weight, don't worry about it, eat it, whatever you want.
Which, of course, we all know, or at least I certainly know, doesn't work. But now you
sure.
have a very interesting thing when it comes to retainers. You have an interesting practice that you do. And I don't remember, I have to confess, what it's called. I want to say it's a lingual retainer, but you actually put in a permanent retainer, in some cases, along the back of the teeth, right?
Correct.
Can you talk a bit about
teeth,
that?
Sure, absolutely. Basically, where people see their teeth shifting around tends to be their front teeth. And if you think about your back teeth have multiple cusps on them, so they kind of fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So every time you bite together, these teeth tend to meet and hold each other in the same place. Your front teeth don't have multiple cusps on them. They can twist and rotate and turn. So what I like to do for my patients is, knowing that that's where the instability of teeth tend to be, what we do is what's called a bonded lingual retainer, a lingual meaning behind the teeth. And it's a little tiny wire that's hidden from anyone's view. It's basically bonded behind the first four teeth on the top arch and the bottom six teeth on the lower arch. I still give everybody a removable retainer as well, hoping that they'll wear their retainer when they sleep. But we all have, you know, New Year's Day resolutions that we all promise we're going to do and rarely keep them. So it's kind of a backup.
Well, so but why would they need the removable retainer if they already have this permanent retainer?
I'll give you a good situation. Kids go off to college. They have the bonded retainer. They break it for whatever reason. They, you know, chomp on something a little too hard, or, God forbid, open a beer bottle with their teeth. there's not an orthodontist around. Therefore, if they have this removal retainer, the removal retainer will be kind of a backup plan. I tend to tell people, you know, life's a long journey, and it's always good to have a spare tire on a long journey.
There you go. That makes a lot of sense. And I can tell you that my own true story is that I did have, as I mentioned, the, I'm sure it makes your, sets your teeth on edge to hear it called this, but I had what were affectionately known at the time as railroad tracks. And I had them removed slightly early to go into the service because you can't have braces in basic training. And I had my retainer, and my retainer ended up getting thrown out in the mess hall. So there's an example of, you know, you just never know what's going to happen to your retainer, and so having a spare makes an awful lot of sense.
You gave your straight teeth to your country.
That's right. I gave my straight, yeah, but now I'm getting nice new straight teeth, thanks to you, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But we do have callers on hold, and we have questions by email as well, and also we have questions through Twitter. So let me remind our listeners that you can call to ask a question at 877-NYK-RADIO. That stands for 877-NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO. You can also send us a message by Twitter at NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO. And you can email us your questions at info@NOWYOUKNOWRADIO.com. And Dr. Rudman Steve from Allen, Texas is wondering, he says, I've got three small kids. I've never had orthodontics myself. So what can I expect with three small children, and when should we bring them in? You know, when might they actually need orthodontia? And that goes to a more general question also, is when is the optimum time for kids to get braces?
Sure. The American Association of Orthodontists, which is our kind of oversight group for the specialty, recommends that people see an orthodontist by the time they're seven. And the reason why they recommend that, and that seems really early to a lot of people, but it's much less for actually doing treatment, but more for screening things. Now, what tends to happen is the canines, which are the pointy teeth, three to your midline, off to left or right, they're the very last teeth to come in. And what tends to happen in about 15% of kids is that the canines can become impacted. And a screening x-ray that's called a panoramic x-ray, which basically gives an overview, kind of like satellite Earth, takes a picture of everything that's going on. It gives us an idea, is, are those canines going to be a problem? And if they are, then there's lots of very easy things to do. Sometimes it involves maybe taking out some baby teeth to provide a path for those teeth. The problem is, if that's not caught early, then it means potentially going up and surgically uncovering these teeth in order to bring them down. Or worst case scenario is, an adult tooth doesn't know what it's eating. It eats whatever's in front of it. That's why when a baby tooth comes out, there's no root on it. Well, there's many instances of kids that basically permanent teeth are really damaged by the canine, so it's just a screening mechanism. 90% of kids can be treated in one phase when they're 12 or 13, but it's just a good idea to avoid problems, and that's why we like to do that screening x-ray around 7.
And when are they most likely then to actually need to go into orthodontic treatment? Is there sort of an optimum age for that?
Sure. Well, as you know, girls are much mature than boys, and we actually never catch up to you guys. So for girls, 11 or 12 tends to be a good age, and for boys, you know, 13 or 14 is a good age. And again, everyone's broken down into a chronological age, a skeletal age from a growth perspective, and also a dental age, and not everybody lines up on the same age. So we might have a kid that's 10 that has the mouth of a 14-year-old, so they might be able to be treated a little early, and the opposite goes. You might have a 14-year-old with the mouth of a 10-year-old, and they may not get treated until they're 16. But it's a lot about timing. So one of the good things about seeing an orthodontist early is they can kind of monitor things, start the ideal time, and be done, you know, within an 18-month time frame for most cases these days.
Well, and that leads us into the next question, which is how long does orthodontic treatment usually last for a teen?
I would say that average time today is in that 18 to 20-month time frame, depending upon if some kids might have a pretty severe skeletal imbalance or a difficult growth pattern or impacted teeth, and that can be a, more of a 24 to 30-month time frame, but overwhelming majority, 18 to 20 months.
Okay. And again, to call in and ask Dr. Rudman a question, how often do you get to call and ask an orthodontist whatever you want, related to orthodontia, of course? The number is 877-NYK-RADIO. or you can Skype in with the link that is on the site, and that site is nowyouknowradio.com. And, Brian, I think we have callers waiting, don't we?
We do. We've got a an old favorite on the line. Rob, you're on the line with the doc.
Hi,
Rob.
Dr. Rudman. How are you, Ann? How's it going? Okay,
well,
here's my question. I'm sorry?
Sure.
Okay, my question is, do all people's teeth move around during their lifetime, or are some of us just unlucky?
I would say if you think your waistline shifts around in life, you're probably pretty correct on the teeth as well. Everything tends to move, and it kind of goes back to prehistoric times when we were all roaming the earth and picking up food, and we had a very abrasive diet, and what would happen is our teeth would wear down, and when you floss your teeth, you go in between, you get those little clicks in between teeth. Well, we used to wear our teeth down to where they were below those clicks, and Mother Nature's answer for that was to keep everything shifting forward through life. And, of course, if things are shifting forward and we're not wearing our teeth down, there's no space anymore, therefore things tend to crowd up. So I would say, for the most part, most people are going to experience shifting in life, just like they experience wrinkles or expanded waistlines or all the other non-exciting things that go on as we age.
Interesting.
So then all the celebrities that you see that keep their beautiful smiles all the way through, you know, their third, fourth, fifth husband, does that mean they're all somehow getting, like, are they getting tweaked? Are they getting realigned, or how
well,
do they
I think
do
it
that?
I think it depends. You know, the magic of orthodontics is you can create really great smiles, and the other magic about it is as long as things are being retained, whether that's a removal retainer or a fixed retainer, things will stay the same, which unfortunately is not the same as your waist. And if I could come up with a retainer for the waistline, I'd be doing late night talk shows and advertising that.
You are doing a late night talk show.
Okay, that's true. Well, I just have to come up with the retainer for the waistline where you can maintain your waistline at high school length.
You know, I think I saw that on an infomercial, actually. So anyway, Rob, thank you for the question. That was an excellent question. And actually, along those lines, sort of, just which shows how my brain works here, Dr. Rudman, you actually said to me once, and I really would love to have you talk about Invisalign as well for our listeners, because I have to tell you that most people that I encounter now in person have no idea that I'm wearing braces. And frankly, I don't even know if you like to call them braces, because Invisalign calls them that, but maybe you might chafe a little at the term because it's very different than the metal technology. But there, a lot of people have no idea about them, and so I'd really love to have you talk a little bit about those. But first,
sure.
My question is, you once said to me that as an orthodontist, you prefer your patients to have the more traditional metal braces because you then retain, no pun intended, a lot more control over what's actually happening with their teeth. And so I don't know if you want to sort of talk about that for a minute or first explain what Invisaligns are and then go back to that, but I found that fascinating. And my experience of you, having been your patient now for several months, is that you're not a control freak, so there must be something to this.
Sure. Well, let's talk about Invisalign. Basically, Invisalign is like a brand name for a car, whether it's General Motors or whether it's Toyota. Basically, orthodontists have been moving teeth with clear aligners for 30 years. And
really?
The difference,
wow.
Yep. The difference with Invisalign has been the first company to marry CAD/CAM technology with these aligners. So what would happen is, as the orthodontist, every time you would come in, I'd have to take an impression, reset your teeth by hand, make this little invisible shell that fits over your teeth that would move your teeth to the desired movement. And I could only do that every, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. So it was very, very expensive because it was a lot of orthodontist time resetting teeth. So where Invisalign came in was they basically allowed us to digitally move the teeth. And then they use stereolithography, which basically takes liquid plastic, turns it into whatever the digital technology is on the computer into a three-dimensional model, and then they make the aligners off that. So what it gave the orthodontist the ability to do is do a lot of aligners with very little orthodontist time, which was great. So it's a great technology. It is limited on what it can and can't do for particular movements. But it's a great technology. It's it's opened up a lot of treatment possibilities for adults that, you know, really want to get their teeth straight without the, you know, nuisance of having braces on. That being said,
okay.
Going back to what you said about having control, I would tell people Invisalign is like a gym membership. You can pay your membership, but unless you show up and actually do the work, nothing's going to happen. So most adults are very motivated to do this, so there's not too much compliance issue. Sometimes with kids, you know, if they have the option to wear something or not wear it, sometimes they don't wear it. Again, it's really all about patient selection. You know, I tell people that you can get from New York to LA with a lot of vehicles, a car, an airplane, a train, but you just have to pick the right vehicle for the situation. If you want to go to Paris, you need a whole different vehicle.
And it won't be the Concorde.
It could be.
You say it's all about patient selection, and I can just only imagine at this point, not at this moment, but generally you're probably wishing that perhaps you had been a little bit more particular in the selection of this particular patient, because I give you a bit of time.
not at all. You've already had braces. You know what the alternative was. You were very motivated. And your case was... Yeah, and basically you had a good bite, and it was a little aesthetic things that could be done. And I think with Invisalign, if you ever go on, if you want to get more information, go on Invisalign's website. But they basically break providers down by experience level. If you're a premier provider,
that's
you've
true.
Done a lot of cases. So just like anything else, you know, when we were talking earlier in the show, practice is a huge issue. And everyone makes a lot of promises, i.e. the product manufacturers, and until you've experienced what it can and can't do, you really want to kind of try to stick with someone who's got a lot of experience so they have the right tool for where you want to go.
Well, you know, I had actually wondered about that because I did go on the Invisalign site when I was first checking it out, and I did wonder whether to get the status of a premier provider, you really actually had to have done a certain number of cases or had just had to pay a certain amount of money for that placement. So I'm glad to hear that you...
Yeah, a premier provider is the top 5% of all Invisalign providers, so it's all about experience. There's no... monetary. You can't pay someone off to get that status. You have to.
So how did you get?
Treat a lot of people.
I mean, that's pretty impressive. You just treat a lot of people. Now that's very interesting because where I go to see you is actually a pediatric dentistry and orthodontic practice, and I
correct.
Know you don't give Invisaligns to kids. So
that's
so it's interesting. Where was this, is this in your Denver practice? And I should mention again that Dr. Rudman practices out of both Cherry Creek and Denver and also up in Longmont. So he's all over the place.
Right. So Cherry Creek is kind of a affluent yuppie area. So I treat a lot of adults, and that's basically where I got the premier status. And what's interesting is that I have a lot of patients in Longmont that seek me out from that area and Boulder because I am a premier provider and they know I have a lot of experience with it.
Okay. I have another question. Actually, I know we're ignoring the callers that are calling in, and partly that's because we're having a little problem with the switchboard, but we are working on that. But we also have these other questions that have been coming in from email, and a couple of them you've already seen. I have to let callers know for the sake of full disclosure, but we do take them on the air. So one of our listeners is wondering... She says that her daughter had two phases of braces for 6 years because she had an open bite. And I'm sure this will mean a lot more to you than it does to me. And when the treatment was complete, it looked really good. But now, in spite of her wearing that retainer, faithfully, her mother says, the bite has completely opened up again. And her treatment used tags. Hopefully you'll tell us what that is, and elastics.
Sure.
And so do you have a comment on the long-term success rate of this procedure? And she's wondering if anything's improved in the past 2 years to make it worth doing it all over again. And I just reading that makes me think, oh, my God, her poor daughter, to have to go through a treatment like that twice.
Sure.
And she ends up saying she wants to avoid orthognathic surgery. And what on earth is that?
Okay. Well, we'll start off with what is an open bite. And an open bite basically means there's no overlap of the front teeth. And that can mean a severe open bite would be the only teeth that you're hitting on are your very, very back molars and nothing hits forward. A minor open bite would be that you basically your canines forward aren't overlapping, so it's very difficult to bite into a sandwich. if you bit in, you probably wouldn't get the meat, you just get the bread. So that being said, I'm also going to explain what a TAD is. A TAD is an acronym for temporary anchorage device. And a temporary anchorage device is basically a titanium post that screws into the bone. Now, the difference between bone, it sounds crazy, but it's a very, very simple procedure. It's not a surgery. It's really not even any anesthetic. The bone has no feeling. The periosteum, which is the membrane that surrounds the bone, has a feeling, so you numb that. The little screw goes in, and they're very, very tiny. I mean, like pin size. So the way it works is, just if you pulled on your finger, no pun intended, for as long as you could, it wouldn't make your finger longer. Of course, the difference is a tooth has what's called a periodontal ligament, and the way teeth move, and it's kind of crazy because you think, okay, well, you can move teeth around, why can't you move bone around? It's because a tooth has a periodontal ligament. Basically, when you put pressure on the periodontal ligament, it sends a signal to the bone to get soft, and on the tension side of the force, it lays bone down, so that's the way teeth move.
Oh.
A temporary anchorage device basically anchors to the bone, which is not movable. And, you know, reading between the lines on this woman's question is basically that her daughter had a fairly severe open bite. And if you think about your jaws being a wedge, the further you go back in the wedge, the more things open up. And what I mean by that is if you took a really small Tic Tac and you put it in your front teeth, it would only open you up the size of that Tic Tac. If you put it in your back teeth, it would open you up quite a bit. So the way a temporary anchorage device would work is they would try to intrude the back molars, meaning taking the Tic Tac out of the back of the wedge. Now, there's a lot of complicating factors to that, and of course, not seeing the case, I can't really comment, but I'll give you my 2 cents worth, is that a lot of times kids that have an open bite then have airway issues. They breathe through their mouth. Their mouth's open all the time, and teeth come in until they touch something. So if your mouth is open all the time, your back teeth are going to come in and touch, and now you're going to be stuck with an open bite. Orthognathic surgery is where they go in and move the jaws. And she was trying to avoid doing this orthognathic surgery, which is fairly invasive. They go in, break your jaw, move your jaws around, move your teeth around. But sometimes that's the only way you're going to get a lasting result. Now, like I said, TADs have been around in the U.S. for about 10 years, FDA approved. They have been around about 20 years in orthodontics. Koreans and the Middle East use them quite a bit. The problem is that we don't know what the long-term results are of these. We know they're safe to use for particular movements. Open bites are the hardest thing for an orthodontist to try to fix. So I think some advice to the lady that wrote in is I would obviously talk to the orthodontist. There really hasn't been a lot of changes in the technology. Some things to look at are, do we have an airway issue where we're breathing through our mouth all the time where that's going to return? Do we have a tongue thrust? A tongue thrust is basically when you are always placing your tongue between your teeth, and the tongue is a fairly good tooth mover, and that could have resulted in the open bite. And I think the best advice is to talk to the orthodontist and say, if we did TADs again, would this be any more stable, or is orthognathic surgery really the only way to fix this permanently? And I would, again, look at the if there's any underlying issues with the tongue thrust, mouth breathing, so on and so forth.
Now, are there some sorts of orthodontic issues or indicators that a child could benefit from orthodontia that sort of there's a nexus between that and, as you mentioned, the teeth are always moving and there's no point at which they just become completely static and stable. And so are there sorts of situations where you could really say wait and see legitimately where, you know, some orthodontists might be much more maybe more progressive and would say, yeah, we could treat this right now, whereas a more conservative orthodontist might say we could treat it, but it might just resolve itself as the mouth and jaw grow?
Sure, and I think that all goes back to experience level and how long someone's been practicing and what they see. So there are a few components to why people have orthodontic problems. If we have a thumb-sucking problem, and our thumb is always wedged between our teeth, and it's also wedged between the roof of our mouth and our tongue, as a child grows, we kind of develop from what's called an infantile swallowing pattern, which basically means we're either nursing or we're sucking on a bottle. The tongue is always low, to an adult swallowing pattern. So, you know, when you're hanging out, your tongue is on the roof of your mouth. When kids have long-term thumb habits, or digit habits or blanket habits or pacifier habits. There's always something wedged between the roof of their mouth and their tongue, so they always have a low tongue posture. They tend to want to push against their teeth or keep their tongue low. So if you think about it, your teeth are kind of a balance between your cheeks, your lips, and your tongue. And generally, most people's teeth kind of follow their tongue if they have a normal swallowing pattern. Well, if your tongue is always low, what happens is the cheeks start pushing in on the teeth as they erupt into the mouth, and we wind up having a really, really narrow arch, which means we're probably going to wind up having crowding. So someone who is looking for these muscle problems, because, again, form tends to follow function, they're going to say, well, you know what, I might send you to someone who's going to help you with this tongue thrust or your thumb habit, and it will resolve itself on its own. And then there's other times when you have to look at someone and go, there's absolutely no way that we're going to be able to not extract teeth unless we do some kind of early treatment. And part of that has to do with how the craniofacial structure forms. There's particular sutures in the face that for girls don't fuse till they're 10, for guys around 12. So if you get in a little earlier, you can actually move bone around. So I tell people that, you know, doing orthodontics is like building a house. And sometimes what you want to do is work on the foundation first. And if you have a four-bedroom mouth with six bedrooms worth of teeth, we need to make that foundation a six-bedroom foundation. And we might do that early. Otherwise, we're going to have to take some of the bedrooms off of the playing field, so to say. So I think it's experience level, individual cases, looking at swallowing patterns. A huge issue is airway. Used to be pediatricians would take tonsils out on everybody. Now they don't take them out on anybody. And someone who is snoring at night as a kid basically is going to be a mouth breather. And they're going to wind up having open bite problems, narrow arches. So these are all things to look at. I don't make the call. I send them to a ear, nose, and throat doctor to make the final call. But it's amazing what you can find.
Well, and that actually leads right into another caller who is writing in and wrote in earlier today. And she's asking, and you were talking about thumb sucking and nursing, and I actually want to ask you about that in specific. But first, you know, callers and listeners always come first. And she says, my daughter is 3 and sucks her fingers for comfort. Do you have recommendations on stopping that habit? How to replace the comfort she gets with something else? It is apparent that the fingers are making her teeth move. And when she does stop the behavior, what is the likelihood that she will need braces?
Okay, we'll start with the habit first. I mean, usually a thumb habit, a digit habit, a pacifier habit, a binky habit, whatever it is that's in your mouth, as long as it's resolved by the time you're 2, you're probably fine. So this gal is 3. So from most conservative to most aggressive is going to be, obviously, a positive reward system. There's a product called Mavala, M-A-V-A-L-A. You can look that up on the Internet and order it. And basically what it is a nail polish that tastes really, really bad. So if you paint it on your kid's fingers, it's not going to taste very good, and they're going to not put their fingers in their mouth. Now, some kids are very pernicious about their habits, and you can see someone called an orofacial myologist, which is a very fancy name for a speech therapist that has gone on for further training that helps kids with where should they rest their tongue, how do we get rid of a thumb habit or a finger habit. And then the most aggressive one is an orthodontist can place what's called a tongue crib. And what it basically is most kids get their endorphin rush when they have a habit from pressing on the roof of their mouth. And so what we do is we kind of put this little appliance in that doesn't allow you to touch the roof of your mouth. It kind of gets boring for the kids, and then they quit the habit. But the big issue with the habit is, again, if your tongue is always low and you're kind of sucking on the thumb, it's making it worse because your tongue is not supporting the inside of your teeth and your cheeks are pushing on the outside of your teeth, and all of a sudden we get a very, very narrow upper jaw and the teeth start to flare forward. So if you think about it, if you stuck your finger between your upper and lower teeth, it's acting like a wedge. So it'll do a couple of things. It'll make your teeth flare on the top forward. It'll make your lower teeth flare backwards. It'll retard the growth of your lower jaw. So these are all important habits to get rid of early on.
That's actually very interesting, in as much as we all know that having, you know, that kids that suck their thumbs for too long, you know, that it can make them have what, you know, lame people call buck teeth. But I had not realized that it could actually reform or retard the proper formation of the jaw. Why why don't we as parents know, why isn't that out there? And, you know, why did I not know that before? I think I'm a pretty conscientious parent, and I've never heard that.
Well, I think that you would probably have heard it from your dentist if that was kind of an issue. I mean, today you have a lot more choices. There's pediatric dentists for kids, and the pediatric specialty of dentistry recommends that we see the kids, you know, as soon as we see teeth, which is generally, you know, a year and a half. And so they're much more apt to kind of look at these habits and see why things are flaring. And I think most modern trained dentists are looking for those things now. So I'm assuming if your daughter or son had that habit, they probably would have brought it up and you know, hopefully sent you in the right direction. I get a lot of referrals from the dentists that refer to me if they see that on, you know, okay, what do we do with this kid? Do we send them to an oral facial myologist for some training or would a habit appliance? The worst case scenario I had was a girl that was quite a bit older, you know, past high school, that they actually had to put a cast on her hand in order for her to quit.
Wow. That's extreme.
That is extreme.
That's extreme. So
but what's amazing is once that habit was removed, there was a lot of huge changes in her teeth just alone. I mean, she had to go through orthodontic treatment anyways, but I don't think, you know, getting back to your caller's question, you know, I don't think that her daughter necessarily absolutely needs treatment, but I do think she absolutely needs to get rid of the habit.
That makes sense. So now let's backtrack up a little bit, because you mentioned, among other things, you know, thumb sucking, a bottle, a pacifier, and you mentioned nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And you may or may not have known this about me. I don't think we've had this discussion. No reason we would have, but I was very active in what's called the attachment parenting community, and I was pretty well versed on things related to nursing and at one time acted sort of as a peer counselor for that. And one of the things in my studies that I learned was that the average age of weaning around the world is between 5 and 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So in the United States and in some of the other quote-unquote, you know, civilized, industrialized, you know, first world countries, now we sort of rush kids off the breast, interestingly, not so much off the bottle. And but in other countries, it's extremely common for kids to still be nursing when they're 3, 4, 5, even 6 or 7 years old. And
sure.
And the conventional wisdom in the attachment parenting community and among breastfeeding advocates is that nursing actually facilitates the proper development of the jaw, and it's kind of well known, and maybe this is, it's kind of apocryphal, but it seems to hold true that babies who are solely breastfed tend to teeth earlier, and the supposition is because they're working their jaw muscles, et cetera, et cetera. So is there a point, because you did mention nursing, where extended nursing can actually be detrimental to the shape of the jaw and the dentition?
And this might go to Brian. I would say 30 is definitely a cutoff. No, I'm going to totally agree with you, because if you think about the mechanics of nursing, the lower jaw has to come forward in order to get the mouth around the nipple. Now, the difference is when I had mentioned nursing, I meant infantile swallowing pattern where the tongue is kind of low to do that, which is fine because the lower jaw is coming forward versus a bottle. Again, something with a bottle, it's something stuck in between the roof of your mouth and your lower jaw for very extended amounts of time. And, you know, most nursing is not going to go on for hours and hours and hours, where a lot of parents send their kids to bed with a bottle. And again, you have something wedged between the upper and lower jaw. So I totally agree with you that natural nursing brings the lower jaw forward and helps with jaw development.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we're on the same page there.
Right, and
Brian needs to cut it out.
Yeah. I wasn't challenging. I was clarifying. So I can be sure, it's because everyone heard this now. We have our expert orthodontist saying that nursing, regardless of how extended, to a point, Brian, is not bad for the development of the jaw, and in fact can be good for it.
Correct.
That's very nice to hear, because that's what we've always kind of assumed. Brian is sending me frantic messages saying, who's he talking about? Because your son's name isn't Brian. Oh, he's talking about you, Brian. He's on to you. That extended nursing. Okay.
I would have jumped in earlier had I known I was a topic of conversation. I couldn't figure out if he was telling me that I needed to stop breastfeeding or I needed to stop my kid breastfeeding. I don't know what's going on here. All I know is...
Brian, I would say you have a really great jaw development. I don't know what that means.
Okay, Dr. Remnantina, calling from St. Paul, would like to know, how do you tell if you've got a good orthodontist or from a bad orthodontist? You know, should you just always accept the referral that your dentist gives you? Like, what are the indicators of a good orthodontist? And while you're thinking about how to answer that, because I'm sure you're going to have to think about that for a minute, because I'm going to take this minute, I just want to tell you a story, which I've told your staff, actually, and I think I may or may not have told you. In fact, I'll tell a two-part story. I know I told you the first part. So you were actually, and I know this is maybe going to hurt your feelings, but not my first. I did have a consultation with another Invisalign orthodontist in the area before going to you, and actually, if anything, I should thank him because he made me want to run in the other direction, and it was then that I looked elsewhere and found you. And part of it was the way he talked to me, and one of the things he told me was, oh, yes, Invisalign will help you, and we're going to make your mouth more feminine. Well, I've never thought of myself having a masculine mouth, and certainly none of the men I've dated have ever complained about my mouth being unfeminine. So I just thought that was a very odd remark. But the other thing about this particular orthodontist, which really put me off, and now that you know about my involvement with attachment parenting, et cetera, it will make sense to you, is that I walked into the waiting room, and there's a huge sign saying, parents not allowed beyond this point. And it wasn't even a pediatric practice. And my thought was, you're telling me that under no circumstance can I accompany my child back to the treatment room, even for the first time? And that just so put me off. And so that doesn't mean he's necessarily a bad orthodontist, but certainly it wasn't a good fit. And
sure.
I'm often asked, as a lawyer, what's the best way to know if a lawyer is good or bad? And I tell people, one of the things that you really have to think about is it a good fit? Is it someone that you feel comfortable with? Because you are going to place your case, in the case of a lawyer, or your treatment, in the case of an orthodontist, in their hands. You have to have faith. And so even if they might be competent, technically, if it's not a good fit, then I think it's kind of like the retainer thing. You're going to be less likely to go back. You're going to be less likely to do what they tell you. And so that's just my story, but please riff on that.
Sure. I think that, going through the filter of decisions, obviously you want to make sure that they're a specialist, and that's what they do, and they're a university-trained specialist. I think secondarily you get your referral from your dentist, and you also ask your friends on who they're going to and what their experience level is. And I will totally agree with you that I think people do better when they actually understand what's going on, that it makes sense to them. And I think the only way you can do that is if it's your child, that you're involved in the care. You know, we always like to give any instructions, if we're giving instructions, to both the parent and the patient. And if it's just you, obviously we're giving instructions to you, but it's very important that everyone is involved and everyone is on the same page. So I definitely agree that you have to have a comfort level, you have to understand what's going on, and I think not only do you get the referral from your dentist if that's who's referring you, but you also ask in your community on what parents' experiences are. And it has to be a gift that you have to feel comfortable.
And is there something, like you mentioned university trained in the specialty, is there sort of a baseline, something you should always look for? I know that also, again, like lawyers, doctors, whatever, you go in the office and they have all these diplomas on the wall, and you don't know if they printed them out from the internet. I mean, I get spam all the time offering me a university diploma. What do you look for to sort of screen to make sure they really are university trained, as you say? What do you look for?
Well, I think in the United States, in order to call yourself an orthodontist, you have to be a university trained orthodontist. there's dentists that will say they do orthodontics, or some dentists will call themselves orthodontists, but they're not. I mean, they're just basically have taken a few courses here and there, which is not saying one's better than the other. It's just that I feel like if you're going to go for, you know, a kidney operation, you want to see a kidney specialist. You don't want to go see your family doctor.
Or your orthodontist.
Right. So you want an orthodontist to treat you from an orthodontic perspective. They have a lot of experience. I would also try to look for someone that has a few years under their belt, because it's, you know, when you think about orthodontics is an 18 to 24 month process. Your general training is anywhere from 2 to 3 years. So, you know, you really don't see that many cases in your life. So the more experience you have, the more you've seen, the more decisions that you can make from experience. And again, like I said, I think it's really important to ask your friends. And if you, just as you did, if you don't feel comfortable, get another opinion. You know, I think if you're questioning the actual recommendation, then I think it's always good to get a second opinion, whether you get along with the first orthodontist or not.
We have another question coming in through our Twitter account, and Jenny says she's in Erie, and she's wondering if you have a child who it's pretty clear they need orthodontic treatment, but they are extremely resistant to it. And she doesn't say why or even how old the child is, but I can imagine any number of scenarios, whether it's peer pressure or the child's too young, you know, young and scared. But what do you recommend in terms of, you know, assisting the child to get over that? And I would actually add, you know, is there a point at which you feel like maybe they so badly need treatment you should coerce them, or can you pretty much always wait until they're more accepting? Well, and given that you have a pediatric practice, that's a great question for you. Like, how do you recommend parents handle that?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of times a lot of kids are very resistant. I mean, it's funny nowadays. I get kids mad at me because I tell them they're not ready for orthodontics, because it seems like all the kids want braces now. It's a funny phenomenon. So I think a lot of times if you as a parent have a concern, I think that if you pick the right person to go to, and you let the orthodontist know that, you know, they're a little apprehensive, then it may not be an issue of saying, let's start right now, but let's talk about it, let's see what's going on. And, you know, a lot of times, if you haven't been to the orthodontist might say, hey, you know what, you're fine, don't worry about it, we can wait, and we can wait for, you know, maturity to set in, and the kid can make the right decision. And if it's something where it really needs to be done, then I think it's just like any other medical or dental decision, you as a parent have to make that decision. But I think waiting and delaying it just because the child's resistant to it probably isn't the best bet, especially because probably the news that you're going to hear from the orthodontist is, we don't have to do something now. The kid can get used to the practice. They can see that it's fun. They can see all the other kids having fun in the practice. You know, the one thing I like about orthodontics is I've always said it's happy dollars being spent, meaning, you know, you're not going in for a root canal and paying a lot of money for a root canal. You're actually getting this really beautiful result, and it's good for your kid. So they might see that this is really not a painful place to be.
Okay. Now, speaking of painful things, this is one of the things that this is a question for me, because I'm very curious about it. I don't think this was a practice back when I was having orthodontia. It's, to me, relatively new, but maybe you could disabuse me of that notion, just as you did with invisible brace, you know, aligners. And that is the concept, and maybe I even have it wrong, but here's how I understand it, that currently there is a procedure by which if the teeth are going to be too crowded, rather than extracting the teeth, you actually spread the palate and increase the size of the upper palate, you know, the palate. I think that's the palate, the roof of your mouth.
Correct.
And as it was explained to me by people whose children were going through it, it is literally sort of stretching the roof of the mouth while it's still kind of soft and pliable to make it larger. And I got to tell you, I cringed at the very thought of that. And it also made me think, well, that's kind of us interfering with what the natural development of that shape of that mouth would be. So first of all, do I have it right? And if so, can you convince me that it's a good thing?
Sure. Well, basically, if you're correcting something, again, if you have a narrow upper jaw, it tends to be issues with airways or habits or so on and so forth. And the way an expander works is basically just like in any child's skeletal structure, there are varying sutures. You know, you have growth sutures and growth plates, so on and so forth, and that's why little kids, as their brain grows, the bones are not fused together. That accommodates the growth of the brain. That's why our heads get bigger from infancy through about 6 or 7. And so with what's called the mid-palatal suture, it's a suture where the two halves of the upper jaw meet. They're not fused together yet. And so the way an expander works is the weak link in the system is that suture. So the expander goes in and we turn this thing. Actually, the parents do it at home. And it basically puts pressure on either side of the teeth, and what happens is the whole upper jaw expands. You're actually moving bone. So why that's good is that if you can do that early on, what kids generally report is it's a lot easier to breathe through their nose, because if you have a constricted jaw, basically the roof of your mouth is very constricted, which means your airway is very constricted, which means your nasal passages are very constricted. And I always say oxygen is a good thing. So, yeah. And so, again, just like building a house, if you want to have a house that's going to accommodate all the bedrooms, and right now you have a 6-bedroom mouth and a 4-bedroom foundation, if you can make that foundation the right width early on, you have a much stabler house that you're building. Versus if you have a very, very narrow arch and you try to push the teeth out too far when you're an adult, you basically wind up pushing the teeth through the bone and you wind up getting recession around the teeth.
Isn't that somehow us playing God with the shape of that child's face?
Well, if you have one leg that's shorter than the other leg, you could say, well, we should just let that play out. But basically, what you have is a skeletal imbalance. And, you know,
okay,
thank goodness for modern technology, you can change that skeletal imbalance. And I'm not saying that has to be done everybody, but generally, if you have a very, very narrow upper jaw, there are reasons for that. And it's usually some type of habit that has played itself out, like I said earlier, form tends to follow a function. And if you have an issue with the function, you know, you're going to wind up having kind of a narrow jaw, and we need to kind of rechange that to get the right form.
So what you're saying actually is that in most of those cases, using that spacer or whatever you call it, expander, is actually correcting something. It's not modifying what nature intended. It's actually correcting something to bring it back to what nature intended.
Correct.
Oh, well, I feel much better about that. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
That's why knowing your house is walking around with one leg shorter than the other.
Well, actually, I am, but that's a whole nother show. We only have a couple of minutes left, and what I really wanted to reserve those couple of minutes to let you tell people about the two practices. I think you only have two. Maybe you have three. I don't know. But to tell them where they can find you and to give out the phone numbers if you'd like and the website addresses and, you know, tell people how to find you.
Sure. Well, easiest way to find me is on the web, and the web address is to advancedorthodonticcare.com or cherrycreeksmiles.com. They'll both link you to my website. Practice in Longmont with Dr. Ed Christensen, who's a pediatric dentist, and that's primarily a kid's practice, but we treat a lot of adults as well. I also practice in Cherry Creek, which is right outside of downtown Denver, and the practice there is probably 50% adults and 50% kids. You know, I'm not a toot-your-own-horn kind of person, so you can look me up if you have questions, and you write to our web address. I'm happy to answer them for you, whether you're in my geographic area or not.
Well, I will certainly toot your horn if you want, because I think you are fabulous, and you have a great manner, and you just treat your patients, at least your adult patients, very well. I have to assume you're wonderful with the kids, too. And I would like to just say thank you so much for coming on the show. I learned so much in this hour. It's amazing.
Good.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And everybody tune in next week. And Brian's going to tell you who our guest is next week. I'm going to put him on the spot because I don't have it in front of me right now. Brian, who's our guest next week?
Well, that's a very good question, Ann. I've got no idea who our guest is next week.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you.
President Obama,
yes.
Right? Better be lined up?
Next week, we're going to be talking about anti-aging technology with anti-aging expert Ellen Wood, who's going to tell us how to grow younger. Talk to you next week. Now you know.